Good morning and welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the
For the record, I'm Diane Vines, Vice Chancellor for the Oregon University System, and this is Jim Coonan, who's Director of Business Alliances for the system. Jim's going to help me in part of the presentation. We wanted to tell you about the exciting developments for the Council for Knowledge and Economic Development. Senator Duncan was one of our sponsors on the bill that established the council legislatively. And as we go through, you'll see that I think he was smart in start setting up this group, and they've done a lot in a very short period of time.
Certainly off to a good start.
Yeah. We started meeting actually in January, and this is the report, which is just about final. This afternoon we meet in Corvallis to finalize this report that will then go to the legislature and the governor and all of the boards. Because we're linking colleges and universities in the state to the economic future of the state, we're calling this ideas into jobs and wealth, which is the benefit of this for the average citizen. If you look on the next page, you'll see that what we believe that we need in Oregon is quality jobs, which are lacking, especially in some of the rural areas. Sustained economic performance, which would help us get out of this slump and hopefully mediate us not getting into such a bad economic slump in the future, and the ability to seize opportunity, the ability to be nimble and flexible and respond to opportunities. If you look at our current economic foundation, I won't go through all of these statistics, but we listed for you where we are in comparison to other states in the kinds of things that help with these kinds of opportunities, the spinning out of jobs, the patents, the creation of ideas, the research and technology dollars, the kind of the educated workforce that is then creative and innovative and spins out ideas. We do well in certain areas, but poorly in most of those areas. We obviously need to do better, both in preparing an educated workforce and in capitalizing on the ideas that come out of especially federally sponsored research. We also need to do better in terms of venture capital for the state. The blueprint for the new economy, which we've been talking about for at least 4 years, is that you need to invest in ideas. Ideas come out of higher education. We are not just workforce preparers. We do create ideas. We are the capital assets of the state, intellectual assets. We need to focus our efforts so that we look at the infrastructure, and the five bills that were passed in the last legislative session really moved us a long ways toward having a seamless infrastructure for moving ideas out into the economy. You need to leverage investments. That means we need to invest early to get high returns on the investments. We need to start locally. All things happen locally, as you know. And then build to expand and look at recruiting out from outside those companies that fill a niche that we're missing with our own company. And then we need to expand our horizons. Alan Alley likes to say that we're not just competing with California and Washington State, we're competing with China and Korea and all of those other world powers. If you look at the new economy, it does provide strong building materials for us to build on. If you look at the number of companies on through the amount of research and development spending from those companies, and that's an important part of the climate of innovation in the state. It's not just university research, but it's also company research. And then the total taxes paid, this is a significant part of our economy. We need to build on that strength. And there are skilled workers everywhere. Jim Johnson likes to say that there's not an industry in the state that doesn't depend on technology at this point. Technology is not just high-tech companies. Technology is driving lumber industry, the wood products industry, the nursery products industries. All of those are reliant on innovation and ideas. If you look at the average wages, however, in the new economy jobs, they are more than double what the average worker in Oregon makes at this time. That's an important aspect of the development, is that we want to create more than just jobs, but high-quality jobs with living wage, family wage.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yes.
Excuse me.
Senator Castillo.
I just have one question. Just so I'm really clear, could you give me an idea of the span? When you say number of companies, 2,900 plus, so who are we talking about? Which companies? Just a general idea.
It's the Intels, Tektronix, HP. So there are a lot of new economy companies that are small. If you look at software companies, they're teeny. So this is just those that are considered mostly semiconductor and display technologies companies. Those are the ones that make up those companies primarily. So they aren't the lumber companies that are using technology. These are just the ones that are generating technology.
Okay, thank you.
So we felt that a new approach to economic development was important. If you look at the bottom of page, is that a five? Yes, it is a five.
Slide 10.
Slide 10, thank you. This is really what we call a GUI partnership. It's a government university industry partnership. And the council pulls in people from all of those areas to work together. The members are listed on slide 11. Alan Alley is, who's the CEO of Pixelworks, is the chair and has done a marvelous job of sort of moving us through. But you'll notice that it's also private sector members of the boards of higher education, and the Economic and Community Development Department Commission, and then four legislators and the state treasurer. And these are in statute. They're required to be appointed. Other members, we've got ex officio members who are listed in statute and or have been added because they are critical to this. The technical advisors are not in statute. They're appointed by the council, and it's an attempt to pull in all the groups that are doing related activities so that we're all at the table together and we're coming up with complementary recommendations and not competing recommendations. The objectives are really fourfold. The first is to increase the amount of research and development activities in Oregon. That's where your ideas come from. We want to dramatically increase the amount of federal money coming into the state. Also, the second is increase the amount of technology transfer and commercialization. Obviously, you need to get those ideas out into the economy, and that's a process that takes some skill. It also takes some money to supervise that and to manage it. We then want to provide sufficient capital for that the technology that's spun out, either by creating a new company or investing in a company that currently exists that's going to help spin out that technology. And then the technologically skilled workforce that accompanies that. So we'll look at, as we decide what areas we focus on and what kind of companies we're going to be spinning out, we need to be sure that we have the workforce that's necessary for those companies. We focused our efforts this first year in three areas: the research and technology transfer, and that committee was chaired by Jim Johnson. The capital and business formation committee was chaired by Scott Gibson, and the knowledge-based workforce development committee was chaired by Jill Kirk. So our private sector friends, not us chairing ourselves here. We do believe that new ideas and new equal new jobs and new businesses, and so our whole focus really was on that construct. By dramatically increasing the amount of R&D, we create new products, services, and businesses, and those are generally high-paying jobs, and people pay then their taxes into the state. One of the first recommendations from the most important recommendation probably from the Research and Technology Transfer Committee is on slide 17, and that's called the Signature Research Centers. We have very distinguished people, especially in our technical advisor group, on how you can grow research in a state. We believe that we don't have the kind of critical mass in any one of our research institutions to attract major national centers or institutes in subspecialty areas. For that reason, we're encouraging the state to invest seed funding in these, one signature research this area this first time and additional ones later on. And that money would be used to pull researchers from private sector, from all of the public institutions, research institutions, and the private research institutions together to come up with a very competitive grant proposal to the federal government for a national center or institute here. This is a new strategy we've never tried before, and the state has never in the past invested directly in any seeding of research efforts. So this would be new, and our competitor states are doing it already on a much larger scale. We feel we really need to get started in this area. Then we would like to build a development corporation that would actually help with the commercialization of those ideas. Second recommendation was related to technology transfer specifically. And we have the Higher Ed Tech Transfer Fund that was developed, was approved through the last legislative session. We put a dollar in it, if you remember, Senator Duncan. And so, in fact, we doubled our investment recently with a dollar investment. One of our members said, I just doubled the amount of money in the signature, I mean, in the Higher Ed Tech Transfer Fund, donated a dollar. So, but we are actually looking for additional funding, and OECDD is giving us some seed funding for this. But in the next legislative session, we're asking that that be fully funded. That would be done through the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department budget. We also believe that we need a technology roadmap for Oregon to actually look at what we think are these niche areas that we should be focusing on in the future. And so we're working with the private sector and those other and the other departments to do that. And then getting the universities to continue to commit their own resources to these efforts is also important to us. I'm going to ask Jim Coonan to speak to you on the Capital and Business Formation Committee recommendations.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Jim Coonan. I'm Director of Business Alliances within the Oregon University System, and my focus is how to get more ideas out of the university translated into jobs. That's my main mission, regardless of where it happens in the state. As Diane mentioned, this group, the actual council, split up into three teams, and she just described to you research and development, tech transfer, and this next section has to focus on capital and business formation. Really, the council is really looking at this as a process. I mean, it's important not only to fund your basic research and then to have applied research to turn those ideas into commercializable ideas, but then also you need the capital and management to actually turn those ideas into companies and jobs. So this particular committee focused on those areas. And as an objective, what they're stating here, and I'm looking at slide 20 right now, it says enhance the ability to start and grow companies and to promote entrepreneurs willing to commercialize ideas in Oregon. So their whole section is focusing, again, on having the management in place and having the capital and making sure that there aren't barriers to the creation of these new emerging growth companies. We don't have the data, but you've probably seen some other data previously that the bulk of job growth comes from these emerging growth companies. If you look at nationwide, we know that there are not that many new jobs that are generated from the already established IBMs of the world. It's those next generation of companies that will really fuel those kinds of jobs. So on 21, they've kind of focused, they broke out their overall strategy, and on the left-hand side, you see a couple of boxes. One has to do with increasing the awareness and interest in Oregon by venture capital firms. Today, we have very few number of local venture firms who invest in Oregon ideas. Most people, if they're going to get funded, have to still go down to Silicon Valley. Maybe they go up to Seattle. We don't have that many firms here in Oregon. So this committee is focused on trying to increase the awareness of venture capitalists in the opportunities occurring in the state of Oregon. And then easing the investment, making sure there's no barriers for investment going forward. And then following through on that, attracting actual qualified individuals, both in the venture community and also in the entrepreneurial community. And then finally, attracting these funds, these venture funds, to the state and investing in Oregon ideas. Their first recommendation on page 22, building a VC industry cluster. Venture capital has not been thought of as its own industry, and what they're recommending is let's think of this as its own cluster, and let's help to develop this industry cluster in order to attract more venture capital to the state of Oregon. So, one, they want OECDD to treat this as an industry cluster, so it would be focused on by them and other economic development concerns. Going to Oregon philanthropic organizations, foundations, to get some of their dollars to invest in venture firms that would be investing in the state of Oregon. And they're also talking about looking at reducing or eliminating capital gains to increase the amount of investment happening in a state. They don't have specifics here at this point, but they hope to have that fleshed out in the next month. And they also want to tie in with whatever's going on in the Senate and the House in terms of not competing with other ideas that are going on there. Slide 23, I mentioned, first off, you need the capital. That's the venture capital, but you also have to have the depth of management to make it happen. So these ideas have to do with attracting these key people to the state of Oregon, including active recruitment, both of the entrepreneurs and venture capital, and then providing incentives to these people to come to the state of Oregon. Also, not just business people, they're also talking about researchers. Key researchers can bring dollars along with them. They're great at developing and attracting monies coming from the federal government. So tying in with what Diane was talking about, the signature research area, they're also looking at attracting, providing incentive packages to attract researchers to the state of Oregon. And then training and networking, we don't do enough of that. We do have a number of CEOs that can do this. They call them serial entrepreneurs, if you will. But we find that they aren't as networked as they might be, so they want to focus on that. And then also training these companies in terms of business management, technology assessment, project planning, et cetera. So dollars, management, and training, those are the three big areas that workforce development, or excuse me, capital and business formation is focused on.
The last of the committees is the workforce, Knowledge Workforce Committee. And obviously, knowledge jobs make us competitive with the rest of the world, and it's important to all industries here. The goals and objectives of the Workforce Development Committee were both to look at the current workforce and be sure that they're up to speed and appropriately skilled at this point, and continue to look at the current workforce to keep them skilled. Looking at the universities for the preparation of knowledge workers in the future, and looking at the people coming, kids coming through the pipeline that will be entering universities, and being sure that that whole pipeline is appropriately dealt with. So the effort to raise the quality of the workers, the capacity of the knowledge-based workers, and the capability for the all regions of the state, and we are concerned that we don't want this to just be focused in the Portland area, because knowledge jobs are all over the state, and we need to be sure that the training is all over the state. If you look at slide 26, you'll see that the first priority really was those people that are already in the workforce or ready for the workforce, you know, workforce ready, like displaced workers, and being sure that they're appropriately skilled. Then the second is growing our own quality workforce, and that's especially related to the universities. And then preparing for future knowledge-based jobs, that's especially the K-12 initiative. The current workforce, we are especially interested in looking at the areas of growth in the state, being sure that the companies that are growing have the adequate workforce that they need. We also are looking at the displaced workers, as well as incumbent workers, and ongoing training needs. I don't know if you're aware, but very, very few of the dollars in the Workforce Investment Act are actually invested in incumbent workforce preparation. That's an important lack in the state. The recommendations include that doubling the efforts of higher education in computer science, technology, engineering, business management programs. So we've added business management here. We haven't done that before, but we do feel that is a crucial part of the workforce. Preparing the K-12 students is important, and you'll notice on the next slide and here that's really the teacher, we're focusing on the capacity of teachers to use technology. And we benchmarked some of these on slide 29, doubling the amount of funding for incumbent workforce training, doubling the number of students graduating from Oregon universities in these areas, increasing the student interest, doubling the number of students entering into post-secondary education in these fields, and training at least 250 additional K through 12 teachers in the use of technology. And that includes then sponsoring 100 additional industry internships for these teachers. The last slide, slide 30, talks about just our sort of overall goal for the economy of the state. We want that to be one that fosters innovation and encourages entrepreneurs to create new products, new businesses, and new jobs in the state. That's our overall goal for the long run. We will also be making a recommendation as to whether the council should continue beyond its sunset date in 2006. And today we'll be deciding that. I believe that they probably will decide that it should be continued beyond that date because of the effectiveness of what they've been doing. We'll be presenting these at a workshop on December 9th with the New Economy Coalition's and Oregon Business Plans meeting at in Portland at the Convention Center, and we'll have a breakout session on all of these recommendations. Duncan Wise has made a commitment to being sure that these are included in the Oregon Business Plan recommendations as well. We'd be happy to take any questions that you might have, Mr. Chair.
Sounds like some exciting things are happening.
Yes.
Any questions, comments?
Mr. Chair, I have one question. Yeah, this is great stuff here. It's wonderful. I guess when I'm looking, though, at your, you know, the members that who come to the table to put to do all of this work, I'm just wondering, I would imagine there are a whole lot of other people that you guys are working with, because missing from this list for me is, you know, anybody like a teacher who would be, I think, helpful, you know, as you guys are looking at better preparation of teachers in
right.
technology use and all of that. And then maybe, I don't know if you've been working with anybody from the department who does work on the workforce development efforts, just to kind of help them keep up to speed, or perhaps help contribute, you know, to help you in what you're doing too. But
right. Actually, what we, Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, we should have brought you, and why don't we send this to them, we should have brought you the list of the committee structures. The committees have additional people on them, and they are the kind of people that you're talking about. For example, our business deans, because that's an important group, are on there. We have these are staffed by different people, so Jim and I staff the Tech Transfer and Research and Development Committee. The Workforce Committee is chaired by Cam Price Braley, staffed by Cam Price Braley, and she's brought in community colleges and K through 12 people into that process. And then the Capital Formation is chaired by Ron Fox with the Department of Economic and Community Development. And so those people are pulled in. So we are on the at committee level. We're open to anyone who chooses to be involved. So as we reach out, we find people who want to be on those committees, and we just add them. So we'll send you a list of those committees.
And I did see that you had Joe Kirk, who, of course, is the chair of the current state board,
right.
Is doing a wonderful job. So K-12 is definitely well represented with her presence and involvement.
Mm-hmm. But also with many other people. We do want both our campuses, but K-12, the schools, and the community colleges to be right in the middle of these recommendations, because they're viewed favorably on the campuses.
This is just such a great part of our efforts to create a seamless public education system in our state. This fits in really well, I think, with those overall efforts.
Thank you. And, you know, what's interesting is if you look at any of those kind of efforts in other states, that those seamless efforts, they are especially effective when they're focused around getting something done together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they're more specific than just, well, let's collaborate, or let's, you know, when it's nursing or when it's teacher ed or something like that, you find that you've got something to hang your hat on. You can make very specific recommendations and not general recommendations that are hard to implement.
Yeah.
So you're strong. Thank you. Very good presentation. I recently book, actually, it came to me. It says the kids that ECOT taught. Children today are very adaptable to the technologies that are available. They love to get on the computer early. ECOT is the electronic classroom of tomorrow, the largest K-12 school district in the state of Ohio, bringing education to the child where the child is in the state. 3,000 students in 2002, from 604 of the 614 school districts in the state of Ohio. These are the kids that at both ends of the bell curve.
Right.
And they're being reached in a way that I think is going to be increasingly an opportunity. Mm-hmm. As they're educated online, they're going to be much more adaptable to the college training portion and be able to go on into technology field. Very exciting development all across the country. Must be hundreds of companies out there that are doing this kind of thing. So I'm encouraged with your efforts and other things that I see happening.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stark, we are aware of efforts like that just around the country, and the Workforce Committee is looking at recommendations regarding an e-learning solution for starting with a single discipline and developing something that would be K through lifelong using the new backbone around the state. And I think you'll see eventually some very specific recommendations in that regard coming out of the committee. They weren't quite ready for this first report, but they are considering that as a possibility for the future. Thank you.
When I think of all the opportunities young people have today and the things that they're picking up, I had someone come to my house today, and I had my young great-nephew there, and I said, you know, historically, I suppose my old great-uncle would be, you know, imparting knowledge and wisdom to the younger. Frankly, he's here to help me with my computer.
Right.
Thank you folks very much for being with us today.
One thing
we'll watch this one.
Okay. I might add, the four legislators are working together to draw up some bills, so you may see something before.
Anytime we get four legislators working together, that is really something that we're all.
Thank you.
All right. Moving right on to the next one. Didn't Jim here? I asked for this. An interesting thing, I think it was brought to my attention, first of all, by relatives of mine who are retired and living in Arkansas, and they read in their Arkansas paper where their local judge was arrested on fraud charges and so forth because he had his motor home registered in Oregon. People questioned, why didn't he have an Oregon license on his motor home? And they checked, and by the way, he was registered to a place in Dickey Prairie. My cousins, who happen to be reading the article and live there, also have relatives living in Dickey Prairie, so that rang a bell to them. So they were contacting me. I did some checking, and we found out that many, many people across the country have registered their motor vehicles in Oregon. And so I was just curious, and I know that DMV is been aware of this and started working on it, and so I said, we'd like to hear from you folks and what's happening in this area. So thank you for joining us this morning and giving us a brief update.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm Lorna Young, DMV Deputy Director, and I you have a couple of packets there. One was a group of press releases that were put together for the committee by the administrator, and then in addition, I have a couple of pages of testimony, and to the back part of the testimony is a list of the registration, vehicle registration fees across the nation, going from the most expensive to the least expensive. So you get some sense of where Oregon sits among our neighboring states and where we sit in the nation.
By the way, as I understand, how many were registered to that particular address from Dickey Prairie?
There were so individuals. And what commonly happens, of course, is people tell other people. And particularly among the RV community, which is a fairly tight-knit community, people vacation together, the word really gets around. And we started addressing the issue, particularly of RVs, several years ago as a result of an RV sales company in Junction City, which was facilitating the process. In Oregon, registration of vehicles and titling of vehicles can be handled by dealers at the point of sale. You all, you know, you sit there and dicker for the car, and you think the deal is done, and then you're there for an hour or two filling out all the paperwork. And among all the paperwork you're filling out to the dealership is the application for title and registration. And they then collect the keys and turn that whole bundle into DMV. Well, part of their process is to flag those individuals that don't have sufficient proof of residency in Oregon, and then they will title the vehicle, or they'll send it off to the DMV office for us to sort it out. But essentially, the reason, obviously, for the desire to register your vehicle in Oregon is $30 every 2 years. Now, for RVs, of course, we charge a fee based on length of the vehicle. So a 32-foot RV would be about $190, $200. But still, compared to states that charge based on the value of the vehicle, there is a considerable savings. And for recreational vehicles worth several hundred thousand dollars, up to $1 million, and some of the really fancy ones, obviously the incentive is to try and get an opportunity to register the vehicle in Oregon or any other state with a small, flat annual fee. Yes. So that's, pardon me?
Yes. On this particular case, the article I read, the registration fee for the judge's vehicle would have been $8,000 at the state. And he was able to pay $1,000 for this clearing. And they took care of it for him. They saved $7,000. I just put the paper report.
Mm-hmm. So as you pointed out, Mr. Chair, clearly there are opportunities for enterprising individuals to broker this kind of relationship. In fact, I just returned from a 3-day conference that AMVA, the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, put on in St. Louis about fraud, and it was eye-opening to look at all the different ways of title fraud, odometer fraud, as well as identity fraud that individuals have come up with enterprising ways to get around the law. So essentially, as we pointed out, that Oregon's low registration fees have created some difficulties for us in trying to sort out who is or who isn't a legal resident in the state. You're expected to be here. You need to provide some proof to us that you're here. You reside here or you intend to reside here. Obviously, those that are in the armed services are can register in Oregon, and they're in, you know, on a tour of duty, or individuals who are like snowbirds and spend a fair amount of their time in other places. But if you pay income tax here, show us that you've got property here, show us that you've got children enrolled in schools, you've got Oregon driver license, you've got, you're paying out of state, and your in-state tuition, a number of various items. And it becomes quite a task, especially at our border DMV field offices, California border and the Washington border, because individuals do want to register their vehicles here, or they have property in both states. Now, one of the things that we have done as a result of the RV case a couple of years ago is part of the settlement of the Finley case was some money for us to focus a large campaign primarily aimed at recreational vehicle magazines across the United States, essentially tell individuals, don't register here. Register in your home state. We're looking. Where we run across cases where people have already registered and we can get evidence that they are not legally registered here, then what we do is cancel registration. Of course, they do have, under the Administrative Procedures Act, the opportunity to challenge that in the contested case hearing, and we review the hearings officer review that evidence. So we've dealt with a number of these cases over the year. I think it's going to continue to be a challenge for us. It takes some time and energy to sort through that, and the temptation that will continue to exist is because we do have attractive registration fees, but we are trying to work the issue. from the standpoint of, if you will, a good neighbor. If we are denying, it's income for us, albeit not a lot of income, but if we do this, then we are denying other states their rightful revenue, which they are using to cover their highway fund expenses for the most part. And we would expect them to be the same for us. So we'll be part of our good citizenship and part of the members of the motor vehicle community continue to work aggressively as we can to stop this. But there is a strong temptation there. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
By the way, the article about the article well, I think you folks, I'd like quickly glad to hear you're getting news releases in the network kind mm-hmm. of magazines that RV owners read and the word get out. I like this one. Don't even think about registering your RV in Oregon if you don't live there. And that was in the RV Buyer Survival Guide. And so I think you're doing your job well. But I think it's interesting. People are saying, well, it's kind of a joke, register in Oregon because it's cheap. And granted, as she said, by stopping it, we are cutting off revenue for our state. But this isn't the kind of revenue we really want. Any other questions?
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Come over and just briefing us.
Okay? Thank you very much.
By the way, folks, if you happen to hear a fire alarm within the next few minutes, it's one of those rare times when you just ignore it.
Sure.
Now, I don't know if that means the building's going to burn down around us or what, but nevertheless, we've been told to not to change
not to panic.
Don't panic, okay? Just hear it go off for a few minutes. All right, we're ready to move to the State-owned Vehicle Efficiency Task Force report. Thank you, folks, for joining us today.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Duncan and members of the committee. I'm going to start out. I'm Janet Atkins, and I was the legislative committee staff person for the state-owned vehicle efficiency task force that was chaired by Senator Beth Farno this interim. I'm going to explain the handouts that we just distributed and highlight the major recommendations of the task force. Randy Hildebrand, whom you all know from Senator Farno's office, is going to relay his perspective and the senator's after several years of working directly with both the private rental car companies and the Department of Administrative Services on some of these issues. And then Dugan Petty with the department will cover some of the changes that are already underway.
Partially as a result of the task force and partially...
I hope I gave you good advice.
from some of their own initiatives. And I just wanted to mention that Dugan was also a member of the task force. Rod Lohoff, who's the manager of the DAS Motor Pool, is also in the audience if there's questions that none of us can answer. And that's why, personally, I was going to recommend you do questions at the end, because then Dugan can get all the questions and you can forget about me. The first handout is the task force report, and under the cover page is a list, the first page of text is a list of the task force members. You'll recognize Senator Clarno, Senator Hannon, and Senator Morissette. There was private sector and public sector members, other members of the task force. The first page also lists the charge to the task force that came under Senate Bill 817, and I was going to just read that. The task force was directed to study costs associated with state-owned general-purpose vehicles and the feasibility of replacing such vehicles with rental vehicles from private sector companies. They were also directed to consider the impact of replacement of the vehicles on the overall cost of fleet operations. So in order to undertake this, the task force took advantage of the work of a private consultant that performs a regular every other year fleet review of all the state-owned vehicles. For this biennial fleet review, asked the consultant to do this comparison, to compare the cost of private car rentals to the cost of operating state-owned vehicles in the motor pool. So many of the task force recommendations are based on the work of the consultant and the consultant's recommendations. The recommendations begin on, major recommendations begin on page 3 of the task force report. The first recommendation of the major recommendations is that DAS should change its rate structure that it charges to state agencies for use of the motor pool vehicles. And the term that's used in the recommendation is service-based chargeback rates. It's a rate that includes all the costs so that a customer can make a choice between a permanently assigned vehicle to the agency or use of the day trip fleet by comparing the real cost of those to operate. The second major recommendation was that DAS should reduce the size of its tripper or day trip sedan fleet and use rental cars to supplement the fleet during peak use times. The consultants had a model they called the optimizer model based on cost to the agency and rental car costs that they were aware of and recommended a fleet reduction of 106 sedans. That's a 33% reduction for the three motor pool sites, Portland, Eugene, and Salem, the DAS motor pool sites. And estimated that the agency could save up to $260,000 in current expenses or avoid those costs by doing that. The third major recommendation that was that DAS through its budget and management division should further analyze options for financing vehicle replacement. This was a major weakness that the consultant determined in the DAS motor pool operation. And the consultant did give DAS an overall very positive review of its operations in terms of professionalism and operating in a cost-effective manner. But the weakness, this is one of the weaknesses that was highlighted. And the consultant and the task force did recommend looking into this further. Some form of debt financing was recommended by the consultant, and for several reasons, and one of them includes how federal funds are reimbursed, because we end up having to actually charge and then pay back some money to the federal government because of the way we finance the fleet. The fourth major recommendation is that the consultant biennially review the operation of all the agencies that a number of agency fleets be consolidated so that DAS assumes ownership and management. This is the distinction between agencies that own their own fleets and agencies that use the DAS motor pool. And some agencies do both. You can see on the handout under the report, there's a single page handout of the vehicle owning agencies. So some of them that are agency that you might expect to have a large number of vehicles uses the DAS fleet instead and has a small number of vehicles. But for the other agencies that own vehicles, they did not get as good of a report card, under the biennial fleet review, and they haven't in the past two biennial fleet reviews either. And the consultant recommended that some of those be consolidated. There are some problems doing that, and one of the problems is that being able to afford to replace the vehicles in those smaller agency fleets that need replacement. So it kind of ties into the third recommendation. A full set of the recommendations is listed on the remaining pages of the task force report in a table format. Some of the recommendations that I have not covered. You'll note that some of the recommendations are for further analysis. The task force did a good work, but they just had two meetings and felt like that further analysis was needed on a number of the consultants' recommendations. So that's why the recommendations are grouped that way. And they, in several cases, wanted things to be reported back to the Ways and Means Committee during session.
especially about the vehicle replacement method of financing. And there were a couple of recommendations that they wanted to go to Substantive Committee for further look during session or one for next interim. Again, the second handout is a table of the vehicle-owning agencies and how many vehicles they have. And the third handout is the executive summary only of the consultant's report. The two consultants' reports are this size, so we didn't reproduce them for you. If anyone wants copies, we can make sure that we get them. So we did just make copies of the summary and the findings of the consultant. So that, Mr. Chair, that's all I have.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Randy Hildebrand, Chief of Staff for Senator Bev Clarnon's office. And Bev has been interested in state vehicle efficiency for the last six regular sessions. The state does have approximately 10,000 vehicles that travel 75 million miles a year, and it is a concern in these economic times that we get the best bang for the buck. And I'd like to thank not only the task force members, but the folks from DAS, everybody from Mike Greenfield, Bill Brawley, Dugan Petty, and Rod Lohoff, and others that have participated in this very effective process. We have been able to make some headway in determining the true cost of operating the state vehicles. It's very hard to work with apples and orange comparisons, as you could imagine. And Janet touched on a few issues that enabled us to pursue a more accurate determination of what the true cost of operating state vehicles are. And staff has been very supportive in the efforts to identify whether or not there are potential cost savings. And it's my understanding that they are putting out an RFP for a number of vehicles as identified by the fleet services report that states that we could save some money. I think it was nearly $250,000 by contracting out a third of the Portland, Salem, and Eugene motor pool. This should be a seamless process for the state employee. That's one thing that we wanted to make sure is upheld, is that as a state employee, you won't see a difference in the way you check out a vehicle. It should be the same type of standard passenger vehicle that you get from the state motor pool. It would just be supplied by a private sector vendor. So with that, I would like to emphasize that we've tried to keep the state employees in mind as far as difference in services should not be dramatic. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record. My name is Dugan Petty. I'm Deputy Administrator with the Procurement, Fleet, and Surplus Services Division of the Department of Administrative Services. Just to kind of wrap up, we can tell you a little bit about what we've done so far. We had a number of recommendations that Janet talked about, highlighted the kind of high-level recommendations, but the task force gave us a number of recommendations after looking at the report from the consultant, identified ways that we might save, and we tried to act expeditiously on those. One of the recommendations had to do with our fueling island. We had an attended fueling island where we were pumping the gas for individuals that came up. We made that a self-service operation. We did that about 2 months ago, and so far so good around that. One of the downside pieces of that is that under the fire marshal rules, we are unable to treat other political subdivisions that come in and use the fuel up at our facility. We're unable to fuel theirs. The way we can do this is because our own employees may be allowed under the statute to fuel their facilities. So we hope to be bringing forward a legislative concept that may cure that. In addition, the consultant identified that our costs in the day fleet for pickup trucks and for station wagons were high. Once they looked at our costs and figured out what our costs were per vehicle under the new rate structure that they're proposing. So we have removed those vehicles. We no longer have access to the station wagons or pickups in the day fleet. The other thing that both Randy and Janet mentioned was the consultant gave us what we think is a pretty effective tool for operating our Day Fleet business at the lowest possible operating cost, and it's the optimizer model where they take a look at the mix between state-owned vehicles and privately-owned vehicles. They plot them out, and at the bottom of the curve is the lowest operating cost to the state. And that depends upon a number of variables, the rate that we, our cost to operate state-owned vehicles, what our contract costs are for private vehicles, and so forth. But we have got those targets now for three facilities. They're identified on page 45 for each facility by vehicle. And we are reducing our day fleet accordance with these recommendations. However, we won't hit those target numbers until we're able to award and have a contract in place for private rental vehicles. And as Randy said, that will act very much to the user the same way that our state vehicles do now. We will call up the day before and say, hey, we need 15 vehicles. Please have them here by 8 o'clock. They'll deliver the vehicles. State person will come in to get a vehicle from the motor pool, and it'll be transparent to them whether they get a state-owned vehicle or they get a privately owned vehicle. So in effect, we have used this managed competition model incorporated into our day-to-day operations, and we intend to continue to take snapshots of where we ought to be in terms of reaching this lowest optimal operating cost for the state periodically to make sure that we've got the right blend of private to state vehicles. We're pretty excited about that. If we can make that work, that's probably something that not many public jurisdictions have done. And I think it's been really a testimony to the effort of the task force to come to a cooperative solution here. The bid for doing that is at the Department of Justice for review right now. We've asked input from the private vehicle community through the task force, the private rental community through the task force, to give us some ideas of what works and ways that we can drive our operating costs down. So we are really excited about this method of doing business, and we think we'll get some pretty competitive rate from the rental car companies. Janet talked about our rates. We are in discussions with BAM around the proposition of going to this service-based rate structure, which really, if you will, makes each vehicle a cost center and eliminates any cross subsidies from the rates. And it's almost impossible not to have subsidies in any kind of a rate mechanism where you're lumping them into groups. But this way, each vehicle will have a cost. We couldn't have done this 10 years ago, but because Rod and his folks have integrated a fleet management information system that's now tracking these costs, we think we're at a point that we can do it. His folks are working very hard on loading the data in, and we hope to be able to move to implementing this new rate structure at the beginning of the calendar year in January. Whether or not we're able to cut over and base next biennium on this new rate structure is a decision that is yet to be made by BAM, and it really has to do with assessing the overall agency budgets to make sure that this new rate structure doesn't have any inequities built into that budget structure. So we're working with them to identify the consequences of making this move sooner rather than one more budget cycle out. Even if we are unable to do it now, we intend to implement that rate structure so we can run it side by side. So when we cut over, we've got a good database and we've got the bugs worked out. And finally, one of the more minor recommendations that the task force has made through the consultant was they identified that at times we were delivering vehicles to a repair shop, taking one vehicle over and shuttling it with another vehicle. They recommended that we change procedures to either have a towing contract to do that. We have revised procedures so that the repair shop, and a substantial amount of the work we do on our vehicles is done at local repair shops, that they come and pick that up and tow it. So we don't have any staff hours involved, which is dropping a vehicle off and picking it up. So we've implemented that recommendation as well. And that is kind of a brief, very quick summary of the recommendations that we've implemented off of this. We are continue to work these recommendations, and I think they're making good progress, thanks to Rod and his folks. If you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
I just wanted to say to Randy that your mother did some really good work here.
Thank you very much.
It's really good.
She's been working on this a long time.
Yeah.
And congratulations on your selection of Greenfield for deputy.
Yes, I'm very excited.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, next item on the agenda, Paul Warner. Paul is going to talk to us about the report on ballot measure 28 and on the tobacco securitization.
Mr. Chair, it's Paul Warner and Dick Yates from Legislative Revenue Office, and this is area of part of your purview on revenue issues for your interim committee. And what I'd like to do is just talk a few minutes with you about our two research reports we issued a couple of weeks ago. One is review of special session five, revenue actions, ballot measure 28. And then the second one is on the master settlement agreement and securitization of those revenues. Just to remind you, the major elements of the special session five rebalance plan, there are really two revenue items, large ones, and the first, of course, was the temporary personal and corporate tax rate increase, anticipated to generate $313 million in this biennium. The revenue there that is generated is for about one and a third tax years, since it's not coming into, since it is going to apply to the 2002 tax year, we assume that that revenue would come in the spring, as people would actually be paying more or getting smaller refunds when they file their return. The other element is the securitization of a portion of master settlement revenue, and Dick will talk about that briefly. The mechanics of the rate increase is there's only one rate that's affected, and that's the top 9% rate. It goes from 9 to 9.5% for personal income taxes. The corporate rate goes from 6 to 6.93%. So that's essentially a flat rate. Paul, when did we move to 9%? When was that? Mr. Chair, we moved to the 9% as part of the 1987 tax reform. It was in response to the 86 federal tax reform where there were a number of base broadening measures that were taken, and the federal government came down and lowered their rates. Oregon passed something very similar in the 87, by the 87 legislature. Okay, so the last income tax increase we had would have been in 1987.
Well, the rates were lowered then. The rates were reduced, but the base was brought. Mr. Chair, we've had a number of questions about kind of the 1982 measure, and that ended up applying 82, 83, and 84, but that was an increase in all of the brackets, and at that time we actually had five brackets. And we had a top bracket of 10%. That was temporarily increased to 10.8%. For 82, 83, and 84, and then it dropped back down to 10% in 85. And then the 9% came into effect in 87.
Yes.
I think a lot of people understand the last income tax increase in the state of Oregon was in 1982, and indeed we've lowered it once or twice.
The overall rate structure, Senator, has stayed the same since the 87. We've stayed at the 5, 7, and 9.
Something came down at 85.
And 87 was when we lowered that top bracket from 10 to 9, and we haven't changed it since. We have indexed the bracket so that the amount which the rates apply to increases each year. And that's why when the rate at which the new 9.5% temporary tax would apply is a moving target, increasing roughly 3% a year. For a joint filer for the 2002 tax year, it would be $12,550. So for a single filer, exactly half that, $6,275. The rate would apply to 3 years and then goes back to 9% for the 2005 tax year. So if you think about the revenue stream, you're not going to get a full 2 years of tax revenue in the 03-05 biennium because you wouldn't be getting the withholding revenue from the last 6 months of the biennium, because the increase would end on January 1st. So you actually, you end up with $412 million, but that's not a full 2 years. The report on page 3 has a table 1, and that shows you what we anticipate happening for 2002 tax year for each of the income groups. And these are from our simulation model. We have a large sample. And you can see the effect. We've been asked about the difference between the Oregon tax and the net federal tax. The net federal tax dollars is what shows up on the explanatory statement, and that was a decision made by the special session. But you can see the average change in Oregon tax in that column third from the right is $133. That's 5.1%. And the amount of the increase, the percent increase, rises slightly with income. So that for 20 to 30, it's a 4.4% increase. For 100 to 200,000, this is all adjusted gross income, would be 5.4%. So it has a slightly progressive tilt to it. And that's because it only applies to that top marginal bracket, the 9.5%. So people in the 10 to 20,000 bracket don't have much income at the 9.5% amount. Although there is some, because there are a lot of people there that file as dependents that don't have any exemptions. You can also see in our paragraph below that about 390,000 taxpayers we think will not be affected at all. And that's about a quarter of the total. And again, these are a lot of these folks are work part year, or they're high school kids that work at McDonald's, and they're relatively low income, so they don't have any income in that 9.5% bracket. For the average or for a median of what people would consider kind of a typical family, we suggest looking at the 40 to 50,000 group, which is the census median household income is about 43,000. So if you look at that group, 40 to 50,000, they expect about $118 average increase for their Oregon taxes. Okay, so 133 is the average, 118 would be a good reflection of the median. The other issue, of course, when you look at our tax system is that we interact with the federal system, and every time Oregon changes its tax liability, it affects how much you can deduct on your federal taxes. And that's why we have that last column. And again, that's what shows up in the explanatory statement. That reflects the fact that people are going to be able to have more state taxes to deduct. So it works out to roughly a 15% reduction in the net tax burden overall. In essence, the federal government is subsidizing the revenue we get by about 15%. Okay. And the difference between those two columns, the 133 average versus the 114 average after the federal deduction, that $19 difference, that's the impact of the federal deduction.
Yes,
Senator. Because I don't always read these things right. Then what you're saying in that $40,000 to $50,000 median income category, is it the net cost to those folks is about $11?
Senator, the net cost is 107. The value of being able to reduce the federal taxes is 11.
Okay.
So this is net after you take that.
When you reduce your. They save $11 off your federal tax.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Save $11, and the typical amount is the average amount is $19. We did put in some typical taxpayers, because we're always hesitant to give averages because everybody's in a different situation. Depends on your filing status, the number of exemptions you have, whether you itemize or not. So this gives people at least something to look at, and we'll give you some information when you get questions from your constituents about how it might affect different people. I might call your attention to my first example there. Taxpayer A is a good example of where the federal deduction doesn't come into play. That person has
$30,000 in adjusted gross income to dependents, but they don't itemize. So they don't get to use the increased state tax to offset their federal. So they get a $70 increase in their Oregon tax, but also a $70 increase in their net, because they get no federal deduction. If you look at taxpayer B on page 5 there at the top, $75,000, we assume they do itemize, and you can see the difference there. Is they're going to pay $229 more in Oregon taxes, but they also get a reduction in their federal tax, and when you net them out, it's $167 for a net effect on that taxpayer at $75,000. Finally, the last section there, defeated Measure 28, we just listed the general pro rata reductions there and basically refer the questions we get from the public to the Legislative Fiscal Office publication that goes into detail on that. But you can see the anticipated the reductions there that are in law that would be repealed if this measure is approved.
Okay, that's the way the law reads now. The law could be changed by the next legislative assembly, and it could do it differently. So we can say as the law currently reads, this is where the cuts would come, right? If
that's
I'm cutting someone, if I'm writing the argument for the situation, I could use these as long as I said, under current law, this is how.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And, of course, remember, we'll be in regular session, so the presumably the legislature will study these if this is defeated and look at some other options. But yes, if the legislature does not act, then this is current law.
But Mr. Chair,
yes,
it seems to me it would be difficult to do any meaningful changes to this because I forget when the state votes go out, but they go out in advance of the election. In order to give the 30-day notice that we need to give people. So if the legislature, if it fails and the legislature decides to change where the cuts are, you start the tax loss on those 30 days. So then you have to cut more to make up for the 30 days. So I think we're into a difficult situation where there isn't too much tinkering you can do with this.
Chair.
Yes.
And to add to that, I guess what I'd say too is that really what we are doing is making a deal with taxpayers by saying if you pass this, these cuts won't happen. If you don't pass this, so we are saying this is what you're going to buy if you approve this. And so to change it significantly, you wouldn't be following through on that deal.
That's why I want to be careful, because if you read the ballot title, it doesn't say anything. It just says it's going to cut. So the other places where it would be the contract with public as they vote for or against would be in the arguments, and that's why I want to be darn sure. I don't want to say something and I happen to be on the committee. There's Richard and I are on that committee. I don't want to say something that later people say, well, they, the scare tactic, they did this and did that, so forth, and it doesn't happen. But this is probably pretty safe.
Okay. Mr. Chair, one more thing, and then I'll go to Dick on the master settlement, is that keep in mind that these revenue impact numbers are calibrated to the September revenue forecast. You'll have a new forecast as of November 26th, so that'll be released in about a week and a half. Those numbers do affect our estimates because they're tied to what the forecast of the economic activity.
Could get worse, but this is the...
We suspect, and we're pretty certain that the forecast will be worse in December, given the collection patterns we've seen compared to September forecast.
Any other questions, Paul or Dick?
I just wanted to make sure I got the.
Dick, do you want to introduce yourself, by the way, for the record, just so we know you're here.
I've still got one thing to go through here.
You're going to go through the Mount High settlement.
Oh, okay, Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure I was clear that the last increase in the income tax was in 1982, and that we lowered the top bracket in 1989.
Yes. Senator, there was a temporary increase for 82 initially for 1 year, and then the 83 legislature extended that for 83 and 84.
Okay.
And then in 85, the rates went back. You know, the Department of Revenue has a table that shows income tax brackets back to 1930. There haven't really been that many changes. It's just a one-page table. I'd be happy to make that available to the committee. It's kind of a handy reference.
I'd like to have it as soon as possible. I need it by tomorrow.
I will do that.
Anything else on this particular part of the ballot measure? 28. Okay, let's move to the next part, and that is dealing with the tobacco securitization.
Chair Duncan, members of committee, I'm Richard Yates with the Legislative Revenue Office. Back in about 1997, I guess you had all states engaged in suits against one or more tobacco companies, and you had essentially four states settling separately. That was Minnesota, Florida, Texas, and Mississippi. The remaining 46 states and the number of territories, and that includes Oregon, signed a master settlement agreement settling all the suits that they had. The settlement was between the 46 states and four of the largest tobacco manufacturers, including Philip Morris, R.J. Reynolds, Brown and Williamson, and Lollard. They at that time in 1997 had about 97.6% of sales in the U.S. domestic sales. And the agreement called for a number of payments to be made by the tobacco companies, subject to a number of adjustments. There were initial payments which were made in 1998 and will be made in the year 2000 through 2003, and nationally those amounted to, before adjustments, about $12.7 billion. And then you had an annual payment, which was to be made in 2000 and in April of 2000 and every year thereafter in perpetuity. And most discussion of the amount of those payments only looks at the first 25 years, just the way financial people look at it. Everything after 25 is so heavily discounted anyway, they just forget about it. So over the first 25 years, you expect about $208 billion. To be paid by the four manufacturing companies into a trust fund, and then to be divided up among the states. There was also a strategic payment which occurs for 10 years, will not begin until 2008, so it runs through 2008 through 2017, and that nationally again amounts to $8.6 billion. The first two payments, the initial payments and the annual payments, are divided up on a percentage basis among the states, and Oregon gets about 1.15% of those payments. We did a little better than, you know, sort of a straight average, population average among the 46 states. The strategic payments, the last one, are determined on a state-by-state basis, and Oregon's share of that over the 10 years will be $208 million. So these payments then are made by what are called the original participating manufacturers, which is those four firms. So what about the other firms? Then you've got over 100 firms that sell cigarettes nationally. Well, some of those firms have agreed to abide by the terms of this agreement, and they're called the subsequent participating manufacturers. So they make payments just like the four firms that actually settled the agreement. The other group then would be non-participating manufacturers, and these are manufacturers, and there's a lot of them, but their sales are small, that sell cigarettes in the U.S. and have not agreed to the terms of the agreement or were not original participants. As a part of the agreement, the states had to pass what was called a qualifying statute. And that qualifying statute requires the state to enforce provisions which require the non-participating manufacturers to pay into an escrow amount. And the excise tax, essentially, that those non-participating members are paying is very similar to the payments that are made by the participating firms. So everybody is sort of in the same situation, at least as far as competition and having to put money aside to make these payments. The payments that go into escrow from the non-participating manufacturers are sort of on a rolling basis. They go in, they make a payment this year, and that money stays in escrow for 25 years. If the state files any claim against those firms for damages or for whatever reason, then that money's available to satisfy those claims. If no claims are filed or if there's money left in the account which has not been used to make payments to the states, it reverts back to the participating, the non-participating manufacturers. So that'll go on forever, but in a sense, there'll never be more than 25 years in there. Okay. These payments that were sort of look like dollar amounts that the states are going to receive are not really fixed because they're subject to a number of possible adjustments. And what you have there on page two, I've tried to indicate some of the adjustments I can look at and some that I can't in terms of trying to make an estimate of the amount of money that Oregon's going to receive. The first one there, the non-participating manufacturers adjustment, is still in the process of being set up by the states and the tobacco companies as far as trying to find an independent entity. Once they agree to someone to perform essentially this analysis, the job will be to look at the situation where the sales of the original participating manufacturers has declined and determine declined by more than 2%, and to determine whether or not the settlement, the master settlement agreement, was a significant factor contributing to that market share loss, whatever that means. And then secondly, they have to determine if the state was not diligently enforcing the qualified statute, in other words, requiring the non-participating manufacturers to pay into escrow. If that determination is made, then there is a serious reduction in the states, and this would be on a state-by-state basis. So if Oregon if there was more than a 2% decline in the sales of the original participating manufacturers in Oregon, and Oregon had not diligently enforced the qualifying statute, then payments to Oregon under their agreement would be reduced by 3 times the reduction in the sales by the original participating manufacturers. Now, I have no way to estimate that. I assume we're going to enforce the agreement, and we're not going to be subject to that. The other is a litigating releasing party offset. Part of the agreement, again, is that the states will not make further litigation against the tobacco company. Companies for the again the case involved not only just the cost that states have incurred as a result of health effects of smoking, but also a number of other things, including antitrust, consumer protection, and racketeering. All of these things were part of that agreement. To the extent that Oregon should subsequently receive money out of a claim of that sort, then that would be a direct offset to the payments under the Master Settlement Agreement. So in a sense, Oregon would still get the money, but it would not get it as a result of the agreement, but as a result of the subsequent litigation. The three adjustments then that I can account for, the first one is easy, essentially in this time frame. There's an inflation adjustment, so the payments each year are increased by the larger of 3% or the rate of increase in the U.S. Consumer Price Index. And for the time being, at least, it looks like the 3% floor there is going to be control. And in fact, I have applied a 3% increase per year in the payments. The other adjustment is more difficult to estimate, and it has to deal with the reduction in the sales by the original participating manufacturers. We do have a couple of years now in terms of behavior where we know the actual reduction, and I've sort of estimated what that reduction is going to be out into the future. And it turns out that my estimate is a little less than the 3%, so we do have a little growth over time in what those payments will be. so that the inflation adjustment more than offsets for the volume adjustment. The third one there is the previously settled states reduction. In a sense, while there were 46 states who were parties to this agreement, the agreement, in a sense, involves all 50 states because the payments are reduced by the settlement that went to the four states that settled separately, and that's what that last reduction is. And so at least we know that amount. We know exactly what that is, and so I can reduce the payments by that amount. The table then on page two is my estimate of what the payments will be under the master settlement agreements. Through the end of the fiscal year 2001-2002, the federal payments, initial payments were about $8.8 billion, and annual payments, or I guess those are payments to the state, so that would be, those are national payments, $8.8 billion, and the annual payments of $12.5 billion. Now, Oregon's share there, as you see, I've asterisked that, is not the straight 1.15% because there was some interest earned while that money was in account in the general fund. And that's the total amount that was available that we have accounting of as of the end of the last fiscal year. The next row in that table then is the last year of the current biennium, and what I'm estimating is that Oregon will receive $81.4 million, which will give us then a total of $339 is the total amount available through the end of this biennium we're in. Then as you go out in fiscal years 2003-2004 through 2006-2007, on average about $70 million a year is going to flow into Oregon. That increases a little bit in 2007 through 17 when those strategic payments kick in. And then again, I've shown 2017 through 2025, but actually again that is in perpetuity. So those revenues, so long as the terms of the agreement are met, will continue forever. The next section there has a little reference as to what Oregon has done with the money it has received so far. What you had was the intent by the legislature to specify the distribution of those payments, the use of those payments, and also a separate ballot measure which came through initiative petition which would have specified the distribution of those monies. Both failed, and so the monies simply continued to accumulate unappropriated. The 2001 legislature then, and also the special sessions that we've been in, have made appropriations of that total amount which has been received or is expected to be received through the end of this biennium. And you can see there about $209 million was appropriated for the health plan, about $99 million into the general fund, $20 million in family health insurance assistance, $5 million for the Oregon Health Sciences University. And of the remaining amount there, about $5.9 million will flow into the health care trust fund, given the estimates I've made. If I'm way low, up to $100 million will go into that trust fund. The last thing then that the fifth special session did was to securitize a portion of this master settlement agreement payments. And what they arranged to do, or what they did, is to set up provisions for the treasurer with DAS to establish a semi-public corporation for the purpose of selling bonds. And the revenue of that corporation is going to be from the master settlement agreement. And the way it's structured is that the DAS and the treasurer will actually sell to the corporation a portion of the master settlement agreement payments. We're estimating that they will sell 77% of those payments, the remaining 13% being required for the existing OHSU bonds that have already been issued and the master settlement agreement payments pledged to the payment of those bonds. Those are general obligation bonds. They've not all been issued at this point, but we expect them to all be issued. And those will require about $15.8 million per year for 20 years. So anyway, this corporation is established, it's to sell bonds and to make a payment to DAS of $150 million by May 1st. And DAS will then transfer that money to the state school fund for distribution to the school districts. And there's the table there at the end. I've sort of tried to indicate where these payments are going. So you have, for instance, in 2003 through 2006, most of the money being required to service or being sold essentially to the corporation and being used to pay off the bonds issued for the $150 million. Again, this corporation is not yet established. The terms of the settlement of the agreement between DAS and the corporation and the agreement between the corporation and the people who sell bonds, none of these things have been determined as yet. Treasurer is busy working on this and expect to essentially sell the bonds or come to agreement in April. So at that time, we'll know more about the specific structure. And the estimates I've made here are just in terms of my really interpretation of what the intent, the legislative intent was out of that fifth special session, that intent specifically being to pay these off as soon as possible. And so essentially selling 77% of the revenue stream allows them to make a payment of $54.1 million against those bonds per year, and most of that is paid off then by 2006. In 2006-07, again, the payments go to the corporation, the $54.1 million, but $43 of that is returned because the debts are presumed to be all paid off. Thereafter, it's not clear exactly what happens here, whether the corporation continues or whether it goes out of existence. If it continues, the money would then just flow back to the state. Because it's not needed by the corporation if the bonds are paid off. As I read the law, the only way the corporation really disappears is for the legislature to dissolve it. And there is provision in the law for the legislature to do that when the bonds are paid off and the obligations of the corporation are satisfied.
Any questions for Dick or for Paul? Yes.
Dick, during the last recent round of campaigns, I listened to candidates from four various offices explaining that we could solve part of our financial dilemma in the next session by securitizing tobacco settlement funds. I thought I remembered that the way we did this tied up all of the money for the next 4 years, and after 4 years, then a trickle began to come to us. Is my memory correct?
I would say that was the intent of the legislature. There is time, probably, for the regular session, if it were to act quickly, to modify that. We've not reached agreement with respect to bond holders as to what the terms of that agreement are going to be. And those can be modified so long as the treasurer can determine what the package is by April. All right. So if we
could get a better deal someplace, we could quickly. I mean, why else would you change it?
Well, if you wanted more money, you're getting $150 million. Say you wanted $300 million. You can't pay that off in 4 years.
Longer. Okay.
Take a longer period of time.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's been helpful, and I particularly appreciate some of them. Help me the next day or two. Okay. We have a couple things. First of all, you have LC draft 1057, and this came out of the library task force, and they asked if we would introduce this pre-session bill. Oh, excuse me, I'm closing the public hearings. We are in a work session. We have before us LC 1057. Eliminates reimbursements to libraries and making it library loans. It's establish matching grants or other assistance for purposes of licensing electronic databases and facilitating statewide ground delivery of library materials. Only I might comment, folks, you had a lot of people involved in libraries who had a lot of different opinions who came together and came up with this draft legislation. I would recommend that we adopt LC 1057 for pre-session drafting. Is there any objection? Okay, hearing no objection. Senator Ferry Oli has asked us if we have before us, excuse me, I'm going to close the work session on LC 1057, open the work session on LC 270. And this repeals laws relating to county school districts, directs county school districts to become common school districts. And this was some work he did with his committee and revenue, and they've asked that we introduce, I think you have a letter from Ted, Senator Ferrioli, and I'd like to have it introduced as a pre-session bill and just get a lot of discussion from the committees at that time. Is there any discussion on it? Is there any objection to adoption of LC 270? Hearing none, LC 270 will be the pre-session draft. You know, my goal was to have you out of here at 12:35. We're on target. Now, Senator, by the way, Nan, don't you dare leave this room. Senator Starr has asked for a few minutes. I'm asking if you can really cut it down to a few minutes. You want to brief, wants to brief you on this conference he attended, dealing with the reading first and the No Child Left Behind. And so take just a few minutes to that. And I have to step over to see if that's all you're listening as you talk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Early in this year, the federal government passed No Child Left Behind legislation. As part of that legislation, there was the Reading First initiative. And the states then had the opportunity to apply for federal funds by writing a state grant application to the federal government. Oregon participated in that, one of 40 states in the United States submitting applications for grant money. I had an opportunity to serve on the Reading First Advisory Council. We reviewed the initial grant application, made some modifications, submitted our final grant application. It was extremely well done. This is the State Department of Education working in conjunction with the University of Oregon. And our grant request was the 10th grant request approved. Only 17 states have been approved at this point out of 40 to apply. We were approved for a grant of $7.3 million. State Department is working very hard to implement then a school district grant writing application process. They identified by following the guidelines of our grant application 35 school districts who qualify for these grant monies. Now, school district decides, and there's a timeline now. They had the orientation meeting for these 35 districts on November 12th, last Tuesday, I believe, and I attended that meeting. They were informed of the requirements of the legislation, and it's built around five big ideas for reading instruction, which are phonemic awareness, phonics, fluency, comprehension, and vocabulary. It's very interesting to me that because of federal legislation, we're really going to micromanage how reading instruction is carried out in our schools. And the University of Oregon, working with the State Department of Education, is going to provide training to teachers. for those districts who, out of the 35 that have been identified, those who decide to apply, they will have grant writing training in January. They'll have about a month and a half to prepare their grant applications. They'll be reviewed and approved, and then in June, they'll institute a beginning reading, Cohort A, Science of Beginning Reading and Student Assessment, 4-day training for elementary K through 3 teachers and administrators of these schools that apply and receive approval of their grants. The in this interim, between now and then, the University of Oregon, working with an advisory committee, are going to identify approved practices, research-based practices that are effective for teaching reading. And the districts may then select from the identified reading materials or reading instruction materials what they will use in their districts. But the, I think, very ambitious rollout. Of course, it's under federal guidelines for leaving no child behind. And I think the state's doing an excellent job of rolling out the plan. They, at this November 12th meeting, they had, well, 2 pages, front and back, of timelines for implementation. And they're very, very ambitious. But a lot of work has been done, and the University of Oregon's reading instruction, reading development program is going to be utilized heavily for providing the training under subcontracts to the State Department of Education. Teachers will be trained. There'll be monitors in each school. There'll be 3 from the State Department of Education, 3 regional coordinators and monitors to work with site monitors to make sure that the implementation follows the guidelines. I'm just tremendously impressed with the work that's being done and how it's rolling out. It's kind of interesting to me, some of these things I've been trying to do through state legislation for 10 years, and now it's mandated because of federal dollars that are coming to us, and an opportunity really to, I think these 35 districts that they've identified is going to reach almost 75% of the students in the state. So it's, it is the biggest districts in the state that are involved in this program. And so I'm excited. I hope to stay abreast of this and see how it continues to develop.
Thank you, Charles. Well, we made it pretty well. We're 12:45, still within the lunch hour.
Very good.
Is there anything else to come before this committee? By the way, I think this is our last committee, folks, and thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to work.
By the way, the State Department has copies of this that are available if you haven't received one.
Yeah, I think we all. Didn't we all get it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Well, I think they were probably all sent to the legislators.
Okay, thank you very much. And we are, by the way, staff, we are always blessed with fantastic staff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've had a chance to work with Marjorie and Patrick for a long time. And, of course, Janet and Jan have just been great. And Paul, we've had a great team, so it's been good to work with. I appreciate your work. I know we hurried things a little bit, but it seemed like we spent a lot of time in special sessions this year, so we didn't do a lot of other things.
Yeah.